Christ said, "The Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will." Now, it would appear that either unconditional or delayed imminency is implied in this particular parable. Either unconditional can come at any time, or delayed, that is, you expect the thief to come during the night sometime. So there's a delay between the time that you hear this, that there's a thief in the neighborhood, or that a thief has been breaking into people's houses or something like that. In the story, that is. The next is the parable of the household steward. This consists of two pictures as far as the representations. It breaks up the parable of the household steward into two kinds of stewards. One kind is a steward who does the master's will and is faithful in his obligation. The other is one who doesn't do his master's will and is not faithful to his obligation. This steward sends the master off, and when the master comes back, he's ready. His steward is to give an account of what occurred and of his stewardship. On the other hand, we have a different kind of servant. And this kind of servant is not faithful to his stewardship. But when the master returns, well, the master catches him off guard because he really didn't expect the master back. And he did all sorts of things, as it says in the parable. And in this particular one, it appears that delayed imminency is clearly implied. That is, the master doesn't appear to be going down to the corner store for a newspaper. He appears to be going on a trip. And he puts somebody in charge while he's away on the trip. And he gives no indication as to when he's going to return from the trip. And so the steward doesn't know when, what day when he's going to return, or what week. He doesn't know how long the journey is. Master gives him no instructions as far as time. But he's faithful. The first one is. The other one is unfaithful during that particular time. The next one is different. Not steward, but doorkeeper. In the parable of the doorkeeper, here's a person who keeps the door or the gate. He guards it while the master is away, and he guards it while the master is there. It's his responsibility to guard the door 24 hours a day. Now that seems odd, but in the account, it says, whether in the evening, at midnight, at cock crowing, in the morning, you don't know when the master is going to return. So you have to watch. He says, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. He says, be on the alert. Now, for a while, I wondered, how can a doorkeeper watch the door 24 hours a day? And then, I had a student from South America who lived in either Rio or São Paulo. And he said, well, that I can understand. He said, we have walls around a good many houses, and there's a gate in the wall. And there's a person who's responsible to watch the gate, and he's responsible 24 hours a day. I said, does he watch it 24 hours a day? Oh, no, he said, no. He said, somebody else watches and takes turns with him, but he's responsible for the other person. So even if the other person's watching, this person is the one who's responsible. He's the doorkeeper. Ah, I said, that's interesting. It'd be difficult to think how you could watch 24 hours a day on a door. And the Lord says, you don't know when he's coming back. I suggest to you that delayed imminency is clearly implied. And this, again, it's a master taking a journey for a period of time, and you don't know when the master's going to return. So you have to be on the alert. Chris.
Mr. Dunstall, why would not unconditional imminency be applied in this?
Oh, the difference between unconditional is that the master could come back at any moment from the time that he left the house. And delayed is that there is a definite period of delay implied. So that he is...
the idea of a long trip.
That's it. That's it. Now, if Matthew 25 is seen as part of the Olivet Discourse, and for a long time I didn't view it as that, but it doesn't. There doesn't seem to be any way that you can take Matthew 25 out of the Olivet Discourse. Kind of interesting because it stands alone in Matthew. Here's a huge passage which isn't paralleled in Mark and Luke. This chapter 25 of Matthew. Very fascinating. You wonder how it could be in the Olivet Discourse and not be paralleled in Mark and Luke. In any case, we have two additional parables which implied delayed imminency. The five prudent and five foolish virgins, the parable of the talents. I'm sorry, I don't have pictures for those. One of these days I'll get to pictures for those. And I suggest that if you look at the individual ones, the individual parables and analogies, you can say, well, fig tree, delayed or subsequent, days of Noah, delayed or subsequent, thief, unconditional or delayed, and the rest delayed. And if you take one that fits all of them together, that is, the thrust of the fourth section as a whole, it would appear that delayed imminency fits the section as a whole. And my reasons there you read already. Now, views which deny absolute imminency at the present time. Some views take the position that whenever Christ is going to return, we know that he's not going to return now. Whenever he's going to return, we know it's not now. It can't be now. What does this do, the question, to Christ's exhortations to alertness and watchfulness? In other words, what does it do to the thrust of these parables and analogies in the fourth section of the discourse? Why alertness? Why watchfulness? One can say because a servant of Christ should be watchful, should be circumspect in his or her life, should be careful, should be living a godly life. That's all true. But there's more than that in terms of emphasis in the fourth section. There is the emphasis on the uncertainty of the time of his return. And the two appear to be linked together. That is, one should live watchfully and alertly and circumspectively. Why? Because you don't know when the Lord is going to return. And so that presents an emphasis on urgency. And a view that says, as Gundry's view does, that the full force of the exhortations to watch for Jesus' return does not require imminence of the parousia or parousia. And he says, until tribulational events have taken place, New Testament expectancy does not mean to look for the return of the Lord as a present possibility, but to look forward to his return after the events of the tribulation. Now, he says it straight out, and so you can't mistake what he's getting at there. I suggest on page 312 that any view of the last things or future things that claims to represent the teaching of Scripture as a whole must incorporate two elements. One, it must square with Christ's own teaching about his coming in power and glory immediately following the great tribulation. That's clear in the Olivet Discourse. Second, it must square with Christ's teaching about the necessity of constant alertness and readiness in view of his imminent coming. Both those must be emphasized. Now, what the views have generally done is stressed one at the expense of the other. That is, they've tried to relieve the tension. They've tried to ease the tension by emphasizing one aspect to the exclusion of the other. I suggest that the concept of imminency that incorporates these two elements best is that of delayed imminency. And why? Delayed imminency allows us to say, I don't know when Christ will come again, but I do know he may come at any time. Therefore, I must always be alert and watchful and circumspect, so that when he comes, I'll be ready to meet and welcome him. Now, one could say, well, shouldn't you always be ready to meet and welcome him, whatever view you hold? Of course. Of course. But you notice that this incorporates the idea of alertness and watchfulness, the idea of urgency, which appears to be the thrust of the fourth section of the discourse. Not the fact of Christ's return. That's certain. But the time of Christ's return, that's what's uncertain. And in view of that uncertainty, one must be alert, one must watch. Not watch in the sense of standing on top of a building and looking up into the sky. That's a caricature. But watch in the sense of letting the urgency of the idea of Christ's imminent return have an impact upon the quality of your life. Putting the two ideas together. See, that's what Barton Payne tried to do. Now, there are some problems with his view in the imminent appearing of Christ. But he felt that on the one hand, you've got a post-tribulational coming. On the other hand, you've got an imminency. And if you're going to be true to the scriptural materials, you have to represent both and give them their due weight. Now, the question is, can we relate the time of the rapture to the tribulation period in any meaningful way? If the return of Christ in power and glory is to occur after the tribulation period, and that's clear from the Olivet Discourse, and is thus non-imminent in the sense of absolute imminency, to what can Christ's emphasis on imminency refer? Is imminency a characteristic of the rapture? Remember, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, you clearly have the rapture taught. It is not taught there in the word rapture, but the idea, the concept of rapture being caught up to meet the Lord in the air is clearly taught there. Any view which denies that is suspect. Any view which denies the rapture is suspect. You've got to do something with the scriptural material, being caught up to meet the Lord in the air. You can't just dismiss that. So you've got to do something, whether making it one event, being caught up to meet the Lord and returning immediately with the Lord, or being caught up to meet the Lord and then subsequently at a future time returning with the Lord. You've got to have one of those scenarios. Now, the question is, can the rapture be shown to be imminent, and how? I've put in four diagrams that you've already looked at. In regard to Daniel 9:24-27, we suggested this scenario of the details of the 70th seven. You notice the details are fairly straightforward. This coming prince makes a treaty with the Jewish nation. In lieu of that, or in view of that, sacrifice is reinstituted in the temple. In the middle of the 70th seven of Daniel, sacrifice ceases, the treaty's broken. And in its place, in the temple, this abominable idol that makes desolate is set up. At the end of that time, this prince who has desolated the temple will be destroyed in the outpouring, in the flood of whatever God has appointed for this particular person. And presumably that includes this detestable idol as well. That's an assumption, of course. But I suspect that if the prince is destroyed, that his abominable idol will be destroyed as well. Now I suggest, on the other hand, that if we want to preserve the idea of imminency, then I would suggest this scenario. That before the first identifiable event in this sequence takes place, that the rapture be placed, that is, if you're going to preserve imminency in what I consider to be any meaningful sense, before the first recognizable, identifiable event of the sequence, the making of the treaty with the Jewish nation for 1-7. Now, obviously, a treaty can be made secretly. You're going to have a secret treaty. That's been done a number of times, and it's only come out later. It'd be pretty hard to hide, however, the reinstitution of sacrifice. I mean, that's such an obvious thing today. It'd be pretty difficult to hide that. And if the two are somehow linked, reinstitution of sacrifice with this making of a treaty for 1-7, then it would seem that this event, the first phase of the second coming, has to occur before that recognizable event. Otherwise, what you've got is a situation in which time is going by, and instead of looking for the first phase of Christ's second coming and being alert for it, you're actually waiting for these events to take place. Chris.
The previous section that we just went over,
yes,
where we came to the conclusion that the parables were about delayed imminency, that's about the post-tribulational coming of Christ. I mean, isn't that... The text makes that very clear, right?
I proposed delayed imminency.
Okay. Is delayed imminency a meaningful sense of the term imminency? I'm gathering that you're saying that delayed imminency is a legitimate and meaningful definition of the term.
Yes.
Then why... Then why,
in this sense,
why are we having to find something where there's an absolute imminence?
The definition here of delayed imminency is this brief period, admittedly looking back on it, but even looking forward from the Olivet Discourse, a relatively brief time. Terminus ad quem unknown. We don't know the time when these things are going to be done. But a relatively brief time in the lifetime of the apostles when certain events are going to take place. Then after that, an absolute sense of imminency. Okay? So that's what this is supposed to represent. That's what this concept is supposed to represent. And my suggestion is that when you come to the end time, the eschaton, that is, any time from their point of view after that period of relative imminency. Any time after that relative imminency, relative to the completion of these predicted events, then you have absolute imminency, which extends into the eschaton, and again, you don't know how long that is.
Okay, so the dotted line, then, is the tribulation.
The dotted line represents the completion of whatever events have to take place in the apostolic age.
Okay.
But that's only looking back.
All right. So I'm having trouble understanding why I don't understand why we're relating imminency and the rapture. Your second paragraph here at the bottom of page 312 says, "If the return of Christ in power and glory is after the tribulation and is thus non-imminent, but you say it is imminent." I am totally confused by it. What are you saying?
Thank you. Thank you. Let me clarify that. That's very helpful. Scenario, these two go together. And this is an event in its own right. This has two aspects, the rapture and the revelation, one event, and can take place momentarily. But the rapture has to occur before the revelation, even though it's like that. This one has a time interval between, of necessity. Otherwise, you could have this. I mean, if there's no time, so of necessity, there's a time interval. Now, when I proposed this particular view, amongst the various views of the relationship of the rapture to the tribulation, I divided time interval, rapture from revelation. And in this particular view, the second coming of Christ in power and glory would be represented by 2:2. Therefore, non-imminent.
I'm confused. Because you just said it is imminent. I mean, we went to great pains to look at all the passages to say that there's a delayed imminency involved there. I'm not sure what I'm missing.
The problem is, if the second coming of Christ can be represented as having two phases separated by a time interval, and you can talk about the second coming as comprising those two phases, then you can either emphasize the rapture phase or the revelation phase. In the third section of the discourse, my suggestion is, now focusing in, my suggestion is that what you've got going is this thing in the Olivet Discourse. Second coming in power and glory. That is, where Christ comes with his saints in Revelation 19 and is revealed in his glory.
But it's not imminent.
Right. Not imminent. It's after the tribulation. Unless, Chris, you mean it's subsequent imminency.
Well, it seems to me that that's what you're saying.
Okay. What I'm proposing is delayed imminency, which does not have, which does have this phase of Christ's second coming following the tribulation. It does have that phase following the tribulation. So that it's non-imminent unless you mean in the subsequent sense, the third concept of imminency. But it's not imminent in the second sense or in the first sense, unconditional or delayed. It's not imminent in that sense. Yes?
Then, what do you mean on page 311? It looks like, halfway down the page. As to which concept fits the fourth section of this verse as a whole, we have a choice between delayed, subsequent, and unconditional imminency. However, delayed imminency appears in all the illustrations and would appear to be the best thrust of the fourth section of this verse as a whole.
The fourth section.
Okay, which is... Is that chapter 25?
Oh, forgive me. Made a mental jump there. Page 276 following. See, Susan asked the other day, were we going to look at the fourth section of the discourse? And what I've done is, I've done it in pieces. Piecemeal through the parables and the analogies. That's a little unfair, I know, because I was looking at time. We should have gone back to page 276 following and just run through that first and then taken it piecemeal.
But the fourth section is all of the parables that we just looked at.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And those parables are directed towards the post-tribulational coming.
My proposal is that in the discourse, you have the course of the present age illustrated, or not illustrated, but exemplified in various plural recurrent features, not signs, but features. In the second one, you have the Great Tribulation. In the third, you have Christ coming in power and glory, this aspect of the second coming. This aspect is not mentioned. In the fourth section, I'm proposing that it's this aspect that's being referred to.
So it's not the post-tribulational coming.
It's post-tribulational in terms of this aspect.
In the fourth section of the discourse, what is he talking about? That's...
My proposal is that he's talking about delayed imminency and that that applies to the rapture. And that therefore, if you're going to have delayed imminency in connection with the rapture, then my suggestion is that my suggestion is that what you've got going here is, oh, wait a minute. This kind of a scenario in which this is non-imminent, it occurs after the tribulation, this is the third section of the discourse, and this is imminent, and this is referred to obliquely in the fourth section of the discourse. Right.
Jesus, or the disciples asked Jesus, what is the sign of your coming? And I look at this as not being the second coming, because if Christ is, if we think of heaven as being up at a certain place, just for illustration, and if Jesus comes down 2 miles and he meets his saints and then he goes back up again, and then with his saints he comes back down again, goes past the 2 mile mark to earth, he has come twice, at least to a certain point of Mecca. And you know, Jesus is, apostles say, what is the sign of your coming? He says, after the sufferings of these days, then signs will appear in heaven. And if the disciples had asked the question, what is your second coming? And they hear this, oh, they say, oh, that's your second coming. And then he goes on and he says, you know not the day nor the hour or whatever. And then they say, no, wait a minute.
A good many of the older students of predictive prophecy problem on our end, not on their end, as to how those two phases of Christ's second coming can be viewed as one coming. If you're looking here, or here, or here, you still have the same problem of the foreshortening of perspective. These both can be viewed as phases of one coming. Just as you have the problem with the other scenario of Christ's second coming, someone could say, hey, come on. Christ descends from heaven. The saints ascend from the earth. They meet 2 miles up, to use your... They meet 2 miles up, and then they come back again to the earth. But even in this scenario, there are two aspects to Christ's second coming, which the saints are caught up and then they return with Christ to the earth. What's the rationale for that? Even with a foreshortening of prospective, of prophetic perspective, you still have two aspects of one event. And you wonder, why do you have two aspects of one event? That's the way it's Or you can say that's the way it is. It's about all. I can't explain why in this scenario that would be that way. I mean, I can speculate and give possibilities of reasons why saints are caught up to meet the Lord in the air. But I can't give any sound answer to that. In this, if you have a long enough perspective, you can see these two not as a second and a third coming, but as two phases instead of two aspects of the second coming, one event.
This would be parallel to what the prophet saw when they looked and they saw Messiah reigning and Messiah dying.
Yes. Yeah. That's even more extended, that perspective. Christ, when he revealed the sufferings of the Messiah and the glory that should follow, even that could be viewed as very, very close on the heels. But this is very close on the heels compared time-wise to perspective of predictive prophecy. Don.
You usually using the scripture mentioning about coming in glory in the cloud of the second event, the second coming of Jesus Christ. But when we look through the second Thessalonians, we found there is a mentioning about the coming of Christ in glory, with the sound and trumpet sound,
yes,
and in glory. And that mentions about the rapture case, which is the first event of his second coming. So I wonder why we have any other strong scriptural background, supporting verses about his second event of second coming, inside of those glorious coming.
Revelation 19 appears to represent that rather clearly. The coming of Christ with his saints, the army that accompanies him from heaven, and they come, and he comes and is revealed in power and great glory. There are some other scriptures in 1 and 2 Thessalonians that can be sorted out, one in every chapter, that can be sorted out as to whether it refers to the first aspect or the second aspect of Christ's second coming.
Yeah, what I'm thinking that we have those kind of arguments in the last video with my friend. We find those meanings in the air clearly in
1 Thessalonians 4.
Yes, but 1 Thessalonians. But we couldn't find, we cannot find any verses mentioning about the coming of Jesus on the earth, at the earth.
You mean in Thessalonians?
No, from any other scripture.
Well, again, I mentioned Revelation 19 and how you understand Revelation 20, and how you then add Revelation 21 and 22. That scenario. Plus, there's a whole lot of Old Testament scripture which relates to this in terms of the coming of the King, the Messiah, the servant, the anointed one to the earth who's going to reign and rule on the earth. Admittedly, we haven't looked at all that material. I'm assuming that a fair amount of that is covered in the Course of Prophets. Again, I don't want to redo that work and do that all over again. And I realize that's a problem. It'd be better to do it all here, but then we'd have to take the whole course on eschatology. Chris. Okay.
I don't want to press it except that it's in Daniel.
Oh, okay, is it? Okay, let's see the exam question. Which one is that, Chris?
According to the class, the very last one.
Number 20.
Yes. Which four kinds of conceptions of imminency fit with the fourth section of the Olivet Discourse considered individually?
So that means those individual parables and analogies, and then which one fits the fourth section as a whole?
Okay.
We've already answered that, right? We've already answered that.
I don't understand the answer.
Oh, okay.
I don't feel confident that I'm going to be able to answer a question like that.
Okay.
You're saying...
what I think...
You're saying delayed imminency. So when I... I am confused about what is the, where the delay, what the delayed imminency is applying to. The text says a post-tribulational coming. You're saying, no, a pre-tribulational coming. I don't understand what you're saying.
And I'm suggesting that in the Olivet Discourse, that Christ is not telling the whole story openly. That he's clearly spelling out, here are recurrent characteristics of the present age, here's the Great Tribulation, here's my coming in power and glory, preceded by certain celestial signs and human reactions. Then, he gives a number of parables and illustrations which set up a tension, because after just having said that his return would be post-tribulational, his coming in power and glory would be post-tribulational, then he speaks of the tribulation as imminent in some sense. And after the, is that what did I say? Excuse me, see, my head isn't quite working properly. Christ's second coming as being imminent in some sense. And therefore, what I'm proposing is that he himself, although he doesn't spell out the concept of the rapture as you have in 1 Thessalonians 4, nevertheless sets up a tension which then has to be relieved by further revelation. And that's what I'm suggesting, that what you've got in especially the Pauline epistles is additional revelation concerning the second coming, which helps us to sort out, clarify some of these ideas. In particular, the fact of the rapture. And the question of how the rapture relates to the tribulation, how it is part of the second coming, and how imminency applies to the second coming. And I suggest imminency applies, the imminency of the fourth section. Once we learn that the second coming takes place in two aspects or two phases, once we learn that, I'm suggesting that imminency applies to the first aspect or the first phase.
Which Jesus wasn't talking about.
Right. Right, exactly.
So he's talking about imminency of his coming, which he's not talking about.
It raises some severe questions, no question about it.
Even though he is talking about his coming.
Yes, and I'm suggesting that when he speaks about his coming, he emphasizes his coming in power and glory. Doesn't emphasize the rapture. Doesn't even mention it. But I'm suggesting that that emphasis on imminency introduces this tension. How can it be post-tribulational and yet be imminent? That's what I'm suggesting. And in these diagrams, what I'm suggesting is that it can be, if once you learn from 1 Thessalonians 4 that there is a rapture phase to Christ's second coming, that this rapture phase is the phase that can be imminent. That is, if you're going to sort out chronologically the question of time frame, tribulation related to the 70th week of Daniel, the second coming in power and glory, the millennium, that whole issue. If you're going to sort that all out, if you're going to have the tribulation before the millennium, then you've got to say, well, where does the second coming of Christ go? If you're talking about the revelation phase, I've put it between the tribulation and the millennium. That's a premillennial view, admittedly. Okay? Then where does the rapture go? Well, you could put it together as one event with the revelation at the end of the tribulation. You could do that. The question is, how do you preserve imminency if you do that? You say you can preserve it by affirming subsequent imminency. And I say, all right, that's one way to go. Okay? Or even generational imminency, which has the same idea but just adds a dimension, their last generation. But I'm suggesting if you're going to look at the fourth section of the Olivet Discourse and preserve imminency in a delayed sense, then I would suggest to you that the rapture has to be put before the first identifiable event of the sequence, Daniel 77, the Great Tribulation, the Millennium. So you don't have to go to the Millennium, because the Second Coming in power and glory, the Revelation phase, comes between Tribulation and Millennium. So you really don't have to fix that once it's put in that place. Leroy and then Ray.
But that only seems to hold if
you have shown that absolute imminency is necessary.
And
following the period of delay.
That's not been shown. What's been shown is that delayed imminency is what Christ taught, not an absolute imminency, that it's not necessary. But my objection on page 312 is to take and say that anything other than absolute imminency is not imminent. To define it that way, it must be a single conclusion. Right from the outset. Because any form of imminency is still imminency. To qualify it further requires some scripture to necessitate it. But I haven't seen that necessitated. Anything other than imminency being necessitated by scripture. So to claim that these other, that further qualification of absolute imminency is what is required, call other ones non-imminent, seems to just be assuming.
Do you see delayed imminency?
I don't think so. I'm not sure about the whole end of the 12th or anything. I don't see what it
is.
Any of the views, exactly where you say delayed imminency allows us to say, any view of imminency allows us to say that. I don't have to qualify it further. Generational imminency would allow us to say that. Just as well. I'm not sure why we have to qualify it further than just being imminent. Why we have to qualify it further. I mean, we can, but it doesn't seem to be necessary.
Do you see how, Leroy, do you see how in the concept of subsequent imminency, if we happen to be here at this point on the timeline, can you see how Gundry's statement then has force? At the bottom of page 311?
I'm not sure what you're at.
Well, when Gundry says the full force of the exhortation to watch for Jesus' return does not require imminence of the parousia. He said, we're led to the conclusion until tribulation events have taken place, New Testament expectancy does not mean to look for the return of the Lord as a present possibility. In other words, if we're here, somewhere on this timeline, then Gundry's statement that it can't take place until after the tribulation, okay? You have to ask, what does that do to imminency? That is, in the dictionary sense of the word, admittedly, he's now qualifying it heavily and saying, well, subsequent imminency. But subsequent imminency means it's relatively imminent relative to the end of the Great Tribulation. Until that event takes place, and after that, you can have absolute imminency. So you can have that for a brief period of time. You can have imminence, in other words, but it has to be after the tribulation is ended. That's his view. I'm simply saying that's his view.
Yeah.
And as far as the fourth one, Leroy, it's pretty much the same except with the addition of that one dimension. The last generation. Again, even if you're here, okay, then you can say, well, we don't know the day or the hour, but we know it will be within this 25 to 40 year period. Now, of course, if you don't know that you're in the last generation, then that doesn't come in. But if you say, this could be the last generation, every generation could be the last generation. in which case you still have a period of time before the end of the tribulation, because that has to take place. And if you say it's 3.5 years or 7 years, you say, I know Christ is not coming in the next 3.5 years, or I know he's not coming in the next 7 years. Now, logically, it seems to me that if we don't know the time of Christ's coming, if we don't know that, and as you look at the fourth section of the discourse, you ask, is that what Christ is saying? We don't know the time. If he is saying that, it seems to me that then to say, we don't know when he is coming, but we do know he's not coming now. That seems to me to be a logical problem. How do you know he's not coming now if you don't know when he's coming? Is that distilling knowledge out of ignorance? Is that what that's doing? If we don't know, then how can we say we do know? We do know he's not coming now. Seems to me if you say, I know he's not coming now, which Gundry says, we know that. Seems to me that you're saying you are knowing something then about the time of Christ's coming. And he said you don't know. I'm wondering how you get from you don't know to I do know.
Chris, you use the biblical data. It's a way to merge the data.
Well, I guess everybody's trying to do that.
I mean, but it's not a logical problem. You have to take the forthright statement is you cannot know. Neither can you say turn around and say, on the basis of that, he is coming at any moment. That is illogical. That's not correct. Because then you are also distilling knowledge from ignorance. If we're trying to create a construct, then to say that in these places he says we don't know, but in other places he gives signs, then it seems to be a very logical way to put the data together.
All I'm plumping for here and stumping for is that the data be handled, as we all are trying to do, in their integrity, and that we preserve imminency in some meaningful sense. Chris.
Why? Gundry's whole point is to deny imminency.
The reason I'm making my point is because I believe that Christ, in the fourth section of the discourse, teaches imminence.
Where? We've seen an attitude of expectancy that we are told to have. But is it fair to distill or derive a view about the coming because of an attitude I'm told to take? That seems to be a confusion of categories.
Well, if he says, the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will, if he says you do not know which day your Lord is coming, if he says you do not know the time, and from that he makes implications that you need to be ready at all times.
Because of my lack of knowledge, not because of anything inherent in the characteristic of the coming. He doesn't say be ready because they could come at any moment. He says be ready because you don't know. And be expectant at all times because you don't know. Not because they could come at any time. It seems like a very fine line.
I see what you're getting. As far as his knowledge with respect to his divine nature, his coming is fixed.
No, I'm saying our knowledge. He says, on the basis of what we know, he points it up and says, you don't know, therefore respond X. He doesn't say, because of the nature of my tongue, respond X. He says, you don't know. The important point is my lack of knowledge. That has nothing to do with the nature of the tongue.
And it's not my lack of knowledge of the fact, but my lack of knowledge of the time.
Right.
And therefore, on page 310, he says, you do not know which day your Lord is coming, therefore be on the alert. That is, that's the connection which he makes. And in the parable of the thief, he says, the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. For this reason, you be ready. So he makes the connection between the two.
Because we don't know.
Because you don't know the time, therefore be alert and be ready. That's all I'm stressing. Leroy.
Yeah, I'm not arguing against imminence. I think imminence is clear. I disagree with Gunter and he has no problem. But all I'm saying is, for example, you can put any of your imminence views up there, but for that one, for example, you have a period of relative imminence. Is it that if it's able to be termed imminency, it's still imminency. And any of these are, I'm not sure why it's necessary to qualify further. If it's imminency, that's what Christ talks about, is imminency. Subsequent generational.
Thank you. Maybe I didn't define the term sufficiently clearly. By relative imminency, I mean, here I should have clarified this earlier. I mean imminency, and I mean it the way Gundry means it, after the end of the tribulation. And they all mean imminency in this way, by the way. Unconditional, delayed. Pardon? Subsequent and generational. They all mean imminency in this sense. They mean absolute imminency. So they retain the idea of imminency, give it its cash value, dictionary-wise, whatever, whoever's defining it. They mean absolute imminency, in this case, relative to all the generations prior to the last generation. You have relative imminency, which means that it's absolutely imminent relative to the completion of those generations prior to the last one. And that means that those generations have to come by and go by before you get to absolute imminency. That's what relative imminency means, relative to whatever events have to precede it. The same is true with subsequent imminency. In that particular diagram, I should have explained this a long time ago. They all mean absolute imminency. Relative imminency here means that Christ's coming is absolutely imminent relative to the whole present age to the end of the tribulation period. So it's relative to the completion of that period of time. Absolute imminency is relative to the completion of that period of time. I didn't make that clear before this. In fact, I'm not sure that was entirely clear in conception.
Wouldn't it be better not to call it non-imminency?
The only thing there, Leroy, I was trying to call it the way they were calling it. Because they speak of imminency also. But they can talk, and they can talk about a relative imminency, but you have to unpack what they mean by relative, and I didn't do that sufficiently.
So what you're arguing for is that imminency must mean absolute imminency.
They all mean that, except when they say relative imminency, they mean absolute imminency is relative to the completion of certain events in these last two views. And even in the second view, relatively imminent during this period of delay, relative to the completion of that period of delay. The only one, unconditional imminency, that one has absolute imminency right from the word go, from the ascension all the way through. But that doesn't seem to be able to stand, again, from, again, the scriptural data. There was someone else who had a question after Ray and Chris, and I missed him on the first time around. Who was it? David?
Well, yeah, I was thinking about imminency as not imminent still. And then I just...
Oh, okay.
The relative
not imminent until. Now, see, that's just what I said, only I said in much more complicated terms. You said it much more simply, not imminent until. Okay, that's what really Gundry means, yeah. Yes. In fact, he virtually says that when I quote him on page 311. The full force of the exhortation to watch for Jesus' return, then, fifth line from the bottom, does not require imminence of the parousia. Ready.
All of the views have hold to an absolute imminency relative to something.
Good.
Okay.
Except the first. Except the first doesn't have any relative imminency.
Well, yeah, in a sense it does, because when Jesus tells the parable, he hasn't gone. So it's relative to his going.
But it only starts after his ascension, the absolute imminency in this first view. Okay? So, only after his ascension.
So, when Jesus tells these parables, he tells them before he leaves. Now, in reference to the rapture, if we want to think of those as two aspects, he tells the parables of the rapture before he leaves.
I don't think he does.
He tells the parables of the rapture before he actually died.
I mean, he hasn't explained the rapture, okay?
Yeah.
We later understand.
Yeah, that's my point.
Okay, I just want to, rather than read something into it, yeah.
Now, he also said that Revelation, okay, he makes a statement, and later Revelation helps us to put pieces together.
Right.
Okay, well, Jesus says the parables, which we now speak of his rapture, say that they're speaking of his rapture.
Or the first phase of his second coming.
Now, after that, or even before that, Jesus says where the vultures are gathered, or where the carcass is, there the vultures are gathered. So that's and he speaks of it in terms of his coming somehow, the Son of Man in clouds. But he doesn't distinguish them. They're sort of like a complex of events. Now, if later Revelation, and even Revelation in the same text, and then Revelation later on where Jesus says the cock will not crow three times until you've denied him, if that Revelation helps us to adjust or to understand some of what he said, then why can't we say when we get into the Thessalonian epistles where Paul says the Son of Man, I shouldn't say the Son of Man, the Man of Sin, is revealed. Why isn't that